Red 5, I'm going in.
Stay in attack formation.
Hello and welcome to an exciting episode of Trend Fern Report. It has been way too long, but life happens. But as Jeff Goldblum said, life finds a way. So, and which means that we came back. Though we're not as old as dinosaurs, but here we are.
Some of us are closer than others.
Oh.
I'm almost 40, so that's why I said that.
Next
year's 40. I just turned 39, so.
Where did you dig up that old fossil?
He was only like a couple years older than you when they filmed that, by the way.
I'm your host. I'm your host, Justin Gray, and here with me is
John McCantley, standing by.
Aaron Russo, standing by.
And this episode, this is still 2025, so we definitely do have time to talk about this, and it still fits. We're going to be talking about the most favored out of the prequels, from what I've gathered, and from word of mouth. And we're going to be talking about Revenge of the Sith and 20 years of that. So we're going to be taking everybody back to the year of 2005.
Ancient history.
Back when we wondered who let the dogs out. We never knew. We never found out, did we?
No, we didn't.
2005.
We're going to kind of go around the room for this like first segment on where we were back then and what was life for us and what was life for in the background.
A couple of lives ago for you.
So
I got memories.
I'll go first. It was so 2005, I was 12 years old, so Revenge of the Sith would have been my first rated PG-13 movie in the theater. Ooh. So it was kind of a hallmark. It was like a landmark for me. And as far as I grew up in the country, so outside of catalogs, cereal boxes, and I think that was like the one time my mom actually went out of her way to get a cereal box with the lightsaber spoon in it.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
Which I don't know what happened to the spoon. Probably broke. Don't know, but and I do remember getting some toys for Revenge of the Sith. Not a whole lot, because I was kind of entering into the middle school era, where toys were kind of starting to phase out.
And it all comes roaring back, doesn't it? Once you start getting the disposable income.
Right. Yep, that is definitely true. Looking around my massive collection. So, when this movie came out, it was kind of like a big thing for a lot of kids to see it when it came out. Unfortunately, I didn't see it until... So it was released in May. Mm-hmm. I didn't get to see it until around July.
Still in theaters, though, right? They ran movies for...
Yeah.
Six weeks or whatever.
More than...
Yeah.
For 4 weeks, maybe.
I remember seeing it with my dad and my brother-in-law and nephew. And I think that was kind of the first time they, like, us as a guy group did anything. So, and I was It was probably one of the funnest theater experiences I had. And then that Christmas, I was hoping to get it on DVD, but there was, like, no place locally that had it.
Really? Like, they ran out, or you just, they'd never got it?
They might have had it in circulation for, like, purchasing, but...
Oh, like, you were trying to, like, rent it?
Yeah.
From, like, a Family Video or something, or Blockbuster?
That, too. Like, renting it was, like, nearly impossible. Like, even at the grocery store, because we mostly grabbed our videos from the grocery store.
Huh.
Because they had, like, a whole, like, rental section back in the day.
Quaint.
yeah,
remember that?
I think that's now the can recycling area now.
Oh, sure.
So, but, yeah, just, like... I think I've only seen it maybe twice that year. And then we tried to get it like multiple times for my birthday the year prior, but there was like no, like we couldn't find it. Like they kept running out. And then on top of that, it was the only Star Wars movie that was only straight to DVD. So we were primarily VHS around.
I was gonna say, yeah, no VHS for that.
So
yeah, because that was because episode one only came out on VHS.
No, episode two came out as well on VHS
and DVD. But did one only come out on VHS at first?
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
Then it went to DVD like a year later.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Wild.
So. I did eventually own it, but I had to record it on VHS off of HBO. So, back when you could do something like that.
Ancient practice.
Yep.
Yep.
My mom used to, like, pause the ads when she recorded a movie on TV.
Yeah.
We had these ad-less copies of the TV edited versions of movies. And then, yeah, later on, you watch, like, the real version, and you're like, oh, I don't remember that. It's because it was... either mom cut it out or
right,
TV or cut it out.
Censored.
I was like, that's not what they said in the movie.
Yeah.
Like Speed comes to mind. My parents cut parts of Speed out. But when I watched Speed, really, I was like, oh, this is a lot more language in this than I remember the TV broadcast version. Because Dennis Hopper should have known. But...
So that's my history with Revenge of the Sith.
Yeah. So July with family and friends, you said?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, what about you?
I was 18, senior in high school. So I had seen, end of sixth grade for episode one, and then the end of ninth grade for episode two. No, I was end of sixth or seventh, and then end of 12th grade. And saw it opening night, like the midnight, Thursday night, midnight showing at AMC. And there were like, yeah, there was people dressed up and like lightsaber fights in the parking lot before and afterwards. And just like, it was a good vibe, like a total, like, this is the first time the first time I'd seen like a dress up and go to the movies was one of the Pirates of the Caribbean movies. First or the second one at that point. And I don't remember when they came out exactly. I think 03 was the first one, but that was like back then, like that was like when everyone was in like the pirate era, you know, like the pirates were like the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was vampires just after that. but this was like that, where it's just like everyone was hyped. I was super hyped for it. Obviously, this was the era when like people starting to analyze trailers kind of started, not on YouTube yet, because YouTube was just about to come out
Came out that year.
Yeah, actually. But I think it was like,
it wasn't like
the ecosystem of like reactors or analysis or anything, but it was like forums and stuff, or like some online chatter started kind of coming out where people were breaking down the trailer frame by frame in a like descriptive way, like not in the video, but like, yeah. And so like, this was the beginning of that era of like, get hyped for a movie. And obviously like any movies we saw up to that point had this trailer in it and then the TV spots and everything. I was watching some of those. I found some on YouTube from the era, like the TV spots and the.
Oh, it's
like, oh man, I remember this in between like ad breaks for Boy Meets World or whatever. Yeah. Yeah, but that was a great experience. And it kind of it to me this movie and that experience, that's the start of my, like the waning of my Star Wars life, as it were. It's like this hit, and then there was nothing until I heard about like Disney acquiring it, right? Kind of. But this was like, that was like 2012 or something.
Yeah.
So like there were 7 years of almost nothing, at least 5 years of nothing, and then rumblings of a purchase, and then the purchase was announced, and then they just like talked about like, oh yeah, we're gonna do episode 7, and then nothing until what was it, like it was like Thanksgiving of 2014 that they had like the teaser, like it was a year ahead of time, teaser of Force Awakens. So like that's basically 10 years where for me, like that was when I was, you know, as a senior in high school, or after Revenge of the Sith, I went to college, and I didn't have any video game systems or anything with me in college, and so I kind of fell out of like any games I was playing. Like that was like Jedi Academy, Jedi Outcast, the old Jedi Knight game, KOTOR. Those were the games I was like into, and so I missed Force Unleashed. I kind of missed that boat.
Oh, okay.
Right, and I missed
Clone Wars.
I missed the Clone Wars entirely as like a movie or a show or any of that. And then I was college, married, starting to have kids. So it wasn't until I had three kids. I had three kids when Force Awakens came out. Like my third was born a year before that, so he's like a year old. So like a lot of life happens between those 10 years, right? And like that's when I like barely thought about Star Wars anymore. But then I came back with kind of this Disney era, you could say. But so that's why it's bittersweet, because it's like a real nice punchy exclamation point, but then it's just like it's like a strong period. It just stopped for a long time, or an ellipse, right? It just stopped, dot dot dot, picks up 10 years later. Here we go, I'm going again. But it's kind of the end of that era, like a real close of the chapter. But it ends on a high note, obviously. The whole prequel era was like my Star Wars theater going experience, with the preface of like the re-release in theaters and the special editions. That's when I got to see the real ones on the screen, or the originals on the big screen with George's edits, because he just can't help himself, into these new ones. And we're like, whoa. And I've talked about this before. I have a soft spot for Attack of the Clones, because I was 15 when it came out, and just like it hit me on that level as a 15-year-old, right? And it's still like, I still say it's my favorite one. I think Revenge of the Sith is definitely the best one, and like a very close second. But like as far as like favorite one, it's still Attack of the Clones, even though I know it's horribly flawed. But it just, I don't know, it's just like sucks me right back to that nostalgia of that era for me. And that's the soundtrack I listened to on repeat, was the episode 2-1. So that's the one that just sticks with me, like the Across the Stars theme and like the, you know, the arena theme and all that. But yeah, but that the battle at the beginning, like the first couple frames of Revenge of the Sith with like the space battle with Coruscant, that blew my mind at the time. I had never seen anything like that crazy looking.
Yeah, like a space battle. Like
that. Yeah, but I can't even think. We had like Star Trek Voyager, maybe, was like the closest thing in time to that era. And that was like cheesy TV graphic or whatever.
Didn't they have like a crazy battle in First Contact, though?
Oh, that's true. But that wasn't,
I think, that was like the closest.
Yeah.
That, even then, that was.
But then, I don't think it was Firefly before or after this. But that was a TV show too. Was that right before this?
Like, well, that crazy scene from Serenity.
Oh, 2002. That's when the show was.
Yeah, the show was 2002.
Yeah.
And then Serenity came out the same year as this.
Right, but I haven't seen that yet. Someone showed me that in college, so that was after the fact.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, short of like, it's not even the same thing, but like the Battle of Minas Tirith blew my mind too,
couple
years before.
Yeah.
But it's a different beast slightly, because it's like not space. But yeah, this was like the craziest. I was like, there we go. This is the Star Wars we're talking about.
Yeah.
These giant space battles.
Yeah.
Like, that was great. It was a great opening bit, the whole like 20 minutes until they like crash land on that, you know?
Oh, yeah.
That's just like a great opening bit.
So.
Yes.
All right. So, Aaron, what about How about you? I feel like you've kind of talked about it in the past, though. Actually, we did kind of brush on it with the each set sold separately saga that we did.
Yeah.
But I think that we can also like go beyond like the merchandising.
Yeah, my earliest backpedaling a little bit. So I was 35 when this came out. All my kids had been born already. The interesting piece historically for me of this time period, in 2005, I was working at a church and a school, Christian school and a Baptist church. And believe it or not, it was strongly discouraged that you go to a movie theater.
For anything. Except for the Passion of the Christ.
No,
not even that.
No, oh, that's a whole other conversation.
Okay.
But the pastor of the church decided to land on the side of, I don't care, even if it's the Passion, you can't go to the movie theater. And I'm like, that makes no sense. But anyway.
Are you in Vegas?
No, this is California. Still for me. So 2005, I'm working at this church, and to be clear, I didn't necessarily heed that recommendation all the time. In fact, I had to sneak to a theater to see The Passion of the Christ when I was working at a church, which makes no sense. But anyway, my actual first vivid memory of Revenge of the Sith is the merchandising, the Toys R Us midnight opening. And I remember that very specifically because my daughter, my youngest daughter, Hannah, had been in the hospital with Kawasaki's disease. And she was in the hospital for quite a few days, and it was coming up to the night that the toys were going to come out. And I thought, well, I'm not going to make it because she's in the hospital. And she got out the day before. And then I had planned to go to Toys R Us at midnight with my oldest, my son, and a few students from the school that I taught at who were big Star Wars fans. And so that was my first memory, was sitting out in front of Toys R Us for hours. I mean, we got there before the sun went down.
Is that how far ahead of the movie did the toys come out?
It was about a month, maybe, or two. Maybe a month.
I remember a flyer like around March.
Something like that. Yeah, I don't remember exactly. It's interesting. I mean, I'll just say this. I'll just say, I mean, I have very vivid memories of that. And of going into the toy, like, you know, seeing that, you know, that whole thing, going in there and seeing the Grievous toys for the first time, that was probably the highlight of it. Like, and I loved the Revenge of the Sith normal size action figure packaging blew everything else away from before. Like that whole Vader, you know, like that was just incredible. So did that, and that was a ton of fun. And my oldest was old enough to go and stay up till midnight. He has vivid memories of that. But I technically wasn't supposed to go to the movie theater, but I did sneak my son out, and we went at night. We just saw it in the theater. And you know, it was, for me, it was, I have to be honest, like, my confession is that I was for a while one of those, you know, Gen X, cranky, prequel, not so big a fan, but I couldn't resist it. Like I still went to see all the movies in the theater. I still got the DVDs when they came out. I still rewatched those movies over and over again. But I think that my recollection, well, first of all, it was the first time that one of my kids went with me to the theater to see a Star Wars movie. And actually, you know, enjoyed it and remembered it. And that was pretty cool. I remember, even though I still had mixed feelings about the prequels at that time, I do remember very distinctly, like, thinking, like there were some really highlight moments in that. Like, that was the first time in the prequels where I felt like, oh, I felt the connection to the original trilogy. I felt the connection to the story of Darth Vader, and it did help me to appreciate the previous two movies more. because I think it was just, I think part of it was just like watch, like having watched my kids grow up with it as I was watching it and seeing them get so attached to Anakin and seeing them get so sad and disappointed when he fell, you know, which to me, the highlight of the reason why I think Revenge of the Sith works so well is that, and why the prequels, why I grew to appreciate the prequels, is that you could tell a story like that where everybody knows the end, like, right, we all know what the, and there's no drama, there's no suspense in it.
Yeah.
You know what's going to happen, but it was still very, very powerful.
That's why it's like a Greek tragedy, because they knew, they usually knew what was going to happen in those tales.
Right.
But it's like seeing it happen and the characters don't
know. Watching it happen to the
characters. But we know it's coming. You're like, no!
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember a couple of times in the movie, like, really, truly feeling like the emotion of what was going on and how it fit into the lore, the overall lore of Star Wars. But I do think, I mean, I think in terms of like coming full circle, it really was for me the most cinematic, the most epic, the most, like, it felt big, it felt like, I feel like Revenge of the Sith for me felt like what I was hoping episode 1 and 2 would feel like. And it finally hit that way for me. So it has its flaws, but I absolutely, that started me down the path of like growing to appreciate the prequels and appreciate them for what they were. I think for a lot of people my age, I think that if you grew up, like I was 7 years old when the first one, when the original Star Wars came out, I grew up on the original trilogy. And I think that a lot of people my age really struggled with the prequels initially because it was so different. And plus, like, you know, it wasn't Han, Luke, and Leia. It was a completely different story. So it was, I think that gave people in my generation, like, kind of a built-in predisposition to not like the movies as much as the originals. And I still like the originals more. But I've grown to appreciate, number one, that the prequels stand on their own, right? They don't need the original trilogy necessarily to be what they are.
Yeah.
And I had to separate that because I was watching people like my age saying, I'm done with Star Wars. You know, even way back then. Well, that was terrible. You ruined my childhood. I'm giving away all my toys. I'm never going to see one of these movies again. And I didn't get that far. I wasn't like, you know, like, you're dead to me. You know, it's like, whoa.
Until they can learn how to make money off of that.
Right. but I do think that a big part of it for me was being able to appreciate the prequels for what they were. And also a lot of the nostalgia for me revolves around like that my kids were all that at that perfect age for the prequels to hit them the way it was supposed to hit them.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, my kids still kind of tell me that that's really my Star Wars. Like they grew up on that. Like yeah. They, you know, grew up on that.
That's kind of a Gen Z story.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Prequels and Clone Wars is like Star Wars. Huh.
Actually, I remember bumping into your son down in GR and we were kind of just geeking out about the 2003 Clone Wars Micro Bros.
Oh, thing. Yeah.
Which actually kind of leads into Revenge of the Sith.
Yeah.
That was also another core thing that I do remember. I do remember, I think the first, they were split into chapters. But this time, instead of like 5 minute increments, they were kind of extending them to like 30 minutes. So they finally kind of had like the length of a full on episode. Cartoon episode at the time. And I do remember going to chapter 21 where it picks up like right after the last time with Grievous. Because the first time we see Grievous was back in 2004 with the series. So we kind of get more on Grievous from that. And And that was also like the first time that we get to see Anakin with longer hair. So we and like I didn't really get to see the trailer until like I think
Revenge of the Sith trailer.
Yeah, I didn't get to see that until like I think it was like March or some type of other movie in theaters. It was a kid's movie, but I forgot what it was because all I remember was like geeking out because like the trailer showed up.
Even though some of the trailers did drop online, but people were still going to theaters just to watch the trailers and then leaving.
And then the micro series ends right where episode 3 begins.
Right. That's right before the kidnapping of Palpatine.
They show the kidnapping of Palpatine in that. And they
check that out. I haven't
seen it yet. They show Shaak Ti trying to get the Chancellor to safety and Grievous intercepts.
Which that's a deleted scene, right?
Well, that's a weird thing because like Shaak Ti dies so many alternately, twice in Revenge of the Sith.
Mm-hmm.
Like, first it's Grievous, then they decide, nope, we'll do that later with Anakin. And then the video game Force Unleashed, she dies there many years later. And then, I guess canon-wise, they officially made it that she was killed in the Jedi Temple in the Clone Wars.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, they... Yeah, Grievous stops Shaak Ti in the cartoon, like kind of ties her up in electric rope, and then kidnaps the Chancellor, and then Mace Windu comes and tries to uses the Force and like blows a side out of Grievous, and that's how he starts coughing.
Oh, interesting.
Which in the cartoon, like Grievous is like way overpowered. He's kind of like the Batman of like against Jedi. Mm-hmm. Like they were like legitimately afraid of him.
Yeah, remember that one sequence in that series where like they're all and they're just building up that tension.
With build up. Yeah. So they built up Grievous so much to the point where when I did see him in Revenge of the Sith, I was just like, huh. I was a little bummed out, but at the same time, it was still cool to see him, like, wield 4 lightsabers, which in the series he didn't do until, like, the last minute.
Mm-hmm.
That was, like, when we were like, oh, he can...
Split his arms open.
Yeah, he can split his arms.
Yeah.
Because he was, like, fighting with 3 lightsabers and using his foot in, like, one of them. So, yeah, it was... So that was kind of like the road to episode 3. So I think we'll also kind of go around a bit and kind of share our favorite moments out of the movie, and then also kind of end it with end that segment with like maybe their like not so favorite moment of the movie.
There are a few.
So, my favorites, the space battle. Obviously, I've always wanted that Lego set with the Anakin and Obi-Wan Jedi interceptors with the vulture droids and buzz droids, and just like try to recreate that scene. And just like we've never really seen outside. I'd say maybe not since Return of the Jedi have we seen a space battle to that big of a scale. Yeah. You know, I think Return of the Jedi scale is maybe bigger.
Bigger, but not as deep, not as much, like...
Mm-hmm. Not as in
background, not as much filling in of the whole scenery, I guess we could say.
Yeah, and that scenery like still continues like while they're on the ship with the windows.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of a cool thing too.
you can watch that over and over again and just focus on different parts and see all the little, like, it's almost too detailed, like it overwhelms you. But I think it does a really good job of like bringing forth like the chaos of war and the chaos of that scene for sure.
Mm-hmm. That's the level you can cheese in the Lego Star Wars original saga. You can cheese like for studs in that.
Oh, yeah.
That's how you just build up your stud count and is replaying that level over and over.
Yeah. So, speaking of which, I don't know if anybody's caught this, but the V-Wings that, I don't think we see the V-Wings very clearly until, like, the end, like, where they're kind of, like, escorting Palpatine's shuttle to the medical.
The prototype fighters.
They do show up in the battle, but you have to, like, really pay close attention.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you hear them at the end. That end scene where the S-Wing, it puts that TIE fighter scream on them. And like, oh, is it supposed to be like, hey, everyone, like, we're the Empire now, right?
Yeah.
They've already painted, like, the Venator Star Cut, the Star.
Yeah.
Like, they're all white now instead of red and white. Mm-hmm. And you're starting to see, and like, all the uniforms now are like the Imperial blacks and grays for the officers and whatnot. My favorite scene is probably the little opera scene with the Darth Plagueis tail, like when he does that whole exchange from the minute he I don't know, just Ian McDiarmid just absolutely chews that scene up and spits it out. And well, I mean, to me, like, it's that plus everything, like, honestly, all the way up to the like confrontation with like Mace Windu and Anakin's there where he turned like gets lightning orb, like the way that he manipulates Anakin from the minute he's like, I guess, assigned to watch him or whatever, all the way up to that point, that to me is like the most enjoyable and best part of the movie is the Anakin and Palpatine's like interactions and the manipulations. Like, it's so good that I'm like, I wish there was two movies of lead up to this, right? Like, that should have been episode two should have been episode one, right? And they could have spent all of episode two getting up to the point of spending a whole movie with this, like, getting closer and having, like, I'm going to inflate his ego, I'm going to inject doubt, or inject, like, fear of loss, or, like, they're afraid of losing somebody, but I can make it better, blah, blah, blah. Like, the manipulation, and I just want more of it, right? But to me, that's the best part, for the drama part of it, is Palpatine. Like, he just goes full, I don't know, it's just like Ian McDiarmid on display in that movie, even more than the other two.
Yeah, it's kind of weird because, like, there are, like, I hate using this word because I kind of have to be careful, but I have cracker moments. It's like where it's a moment in a movie where you're young, if it's a little long, you can go get some crackers.
those are for you, like, the talking ones.
But and or I would have gone to the store.
But, I mean, yeah, like a scene with that's like 3 or 4 or 5 minutes without much camera movement.
Yeah.
Just dialogue, drama. That is harder to follow for
a kid. But like that opera scene was not a cracker moment for me. I was always kind of intrigued with how he told it was weird. I can definitely like, I would personally like hire Ian McDiarmid to like tell my kids bedtime stories.
Oh, he should totally do that.
Bedtime stories with Palpatine.
I've told you the tale. Yes.
The troll and then under the
book,
bridge.
The book Plagueis makes that even better because it's like that's not just some like mythological tale he's telling. He's like literally saying like, yep. That was my master. It's
a confession.
Yeah, he's confessing.
He is like when he's.
But he's not. But nobody knows it.
Right. Where can we learn this power? And he's like, "I got you." Like a hook, line, and sinker. You know, this is so delicious.
I was intrigued. Like with that, like Lang was like ironic. He could save others from death, but not himself. And it's like you can tell that there was something there, like. Well, I like how they, like, that was just pure, it was like, so, to kind of, like, backtrack, George Lucas doesn't really know how to direct actors in a way.
Right.
And like he says, like, I wrote it down, just do it.
Mm-hmm.
And
faster, more intense.
Either that or faster and more intense. And I definitely could tell that he was like Ian McDiarmid didn't, like, wasn't lost in that. Like, he did his own thing when he was, and it worked.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think if they don't need direction, they do great. Uh-huh. But if they need direction, they don't get good direction. And that's how it turns out. It's like the younger actors don't
think as good. That's gone. Yeah, I think that's kind of what Hayden and Natalie kind of had to struggle with. And at times, Ewan. We'll get to that later. So what about you, Aaron? What would be your highlight moment of...
I mean, the opening space battle is clearly a highlight from from a visual standpoint, setting the stage of the Clone Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I thought it was very effective. I loved that opening sequence, the whole space battle, rescuing Palpatine and everything. There's so many things that are done during that period that set the movie up so well, right? You get the banter back and forth between Anakin and Obi-Wan when they're flying. You know, it develops that that brotherhood, kind of like they're buddies and they have a history together. They know these things about each other, and they're in battle together. And then you have their banter when they're on the ship. And then you get the one of the coolest moments is when Anakin beheads,
and he's got that look on his face,
oh
no.
Do it. And just the way that Dooku looks at him, dude, what the fuck? I thought I was the guy.
Totally get thrown under the bus.
Yeah. And I think that all of that, like that whole sequence is all of it is a highlight, including the introduction of Grievous, who I think is still to this day probably the coolest character concept in the prequels, visually,
mm-hmm.
Sound, visual, everything, just cool factor to 11. Wow. That introduction to Grievous to me was fantastic. But I think that but those moments are only to set up, I think, what are the highlight moments, which I think the opera scene is clearly one of them, because it is really the linchpin, right, for all of Anakin's experiences up to that point.
Yep.
And then how Palpatine is so strategically implementing, planting the seeds that he knows will lead Anakin to take his side instead of the Jedi. But I think, is there any one, for me, the sequence that really gets me is the sequence when Anakin is on the table being turned into Vader while they show Padme giving birth.
Oh, right.
And to me, that was when, that's when you seal the deal, right? Okay, here it is. And you're seeing these, the historic moments of the whole Skywalker saga, right? Anakin, watching him laying there in pain, struggling, and then juxtaposing that as Padme is giving birth and naming Luke and Leia, and it's so tragic and it's so sad and it's so cinematic, the music and the way it's cuts back and forth, to me those were the even though there wasn't a lot of dialogue or anything, I think that was the peak for me of feeling the story come full circle and be cohesive. But obviously the lightsaber duel between Anakin and Obi-Wan, especially the first part for me, I lose it a little bit when they're on the lava because it gets kind of cartoonish.
Mm-hmm.
But the opening parts and then the end are fantastic. But yeah, like, I don't know. There was just something about, like, seeing Anakin when that helmet closes, and you're like,
and he takes a breath for the first time.
Yeah, and like, breath. Then you fully, you know, realize who is in that costume, who's in that helmet, and that he's literally being encased in this armor while his children are being born. And the tragedy of, like, even though, right, it's widely regarded to be the most cringy moment, that, but it is so, like, oh, like, I mean, like, if you could have just done that scene a little better, because that is the moment, right? It's like, when he's told that he killed Padme, even though he didn't, but Padme is dead, and he doesn't know that his children are even alive, and...
Or that there's even two of them, right?
Right.
Does he know there's
right.
twins?
No, there's twins.
Which I don't know how he couldn't sense twins in her... Like, can't you sense that? Like, in the Force?
Yeah,
here and there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what it comes what it comes down to is that you right, like,
I can't.
It's that moment where Anakin is like, it's why I'm looking forward to that new Vader book that's coming out and the previous one that came out that kind of like explores his mindset right after Revenge of the Sith, which is that he is more than anything a prisoner of his own regret.
Mm-hmm.
And his own bad choices, and that is what, you know, makes that those scenes so powerful, is that, you know, and it, yeah, those are the things that really stick out to me. There are many moments, but I think a really good moment also is that scene where he's waiting in the Jedi temple and the sun's coming down on Coruscant, and there's that music, and you can tell, like, he's really struggling, like, what do I do? And then Padme's looking, and she's almost sensing, like, something's wrong, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like the very last scene, or scenes, where, you know, they show, like, baby Leia on Alderaan, and then, obviously, like, Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru with baby, and Owen's, like, standing and looking exactly like
Luke
does, like, and, like, everything, and you're just, like, completely, I think that's the very last scene, right,
is
looking out the twin sunset, and it's just, like, man, that's, like, he literally sets it right off, and then, obviously, they've made things that interject in between the episode 3 and 4, but well, skip all that, like, just leave it alone, and, like, tie it all in a bow, it's fine, right, because the next time we see Leia, she's, like, outrunning grown men, right,
like that was like weird, like I think I was joking with somebody like one time, and like that last scene where Obi-Wan turns around, I just ruined that moment, but I'm like, well, I'm off to work at a fish market near Anchorhead for the rest of my life. It's like, oh,
they should have had Leia in in episode 9 of Andor, like when Bail gets up there to kick it off, they should have had her like just a little bit out of focus behind in the same pod, like you could tell it's where the buns,
mm-hmm.
but you don't even need to have like her face clearly, it's just like she was there, she's 17, junior senator, or
right.
senator in
mm-hmm.
or whatever,
yeah, that would have been very,
or like have her like run into her in the hallway or something, have some kind of Leia cameo would have been perfect for that mm-hmm. scene, that episode, but oh well.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, a lot of good moments in that movie, and I think that like I was like, for me, like all the good moments made me realize like that the first two, episode 1 and 2, weren't as bad as I was. Because if episode 1 and 2 were as bad as I sometimes thought they were, then episode 3 wouldn't have worked as much. But we can talk more about
that. Well, they do a good job because like in 1, Obi-Wan and Anakin barely interact.
Uh-huh.
And then in 2, it's not very healthy either round. Like, they just get on each other's nerves and just, they're like never.
Yeah.
And then they separate them physically. Like, for the point mm-hmm. of the movie is Obi-Wan does his like investigation thing, and then there's the love thing over there. And And then when he come when they're back, he's like, good job. Like, he's still like kind of being a jerk to Anakin, I guess, and they kind of find a way, but then he's like, you know, Anakin, don't. And then he runs and gets himself yeeted by Dooku, and like, he's like never listening. And it's like, see, this is why Obi-Wan has to be like this, because Anakin's like that, right? And then the Clone Wars does a lot, obviously, to like develop their relationship, but that was all after this. In this movie, they spend the first whatever, that whole big sequence at the beginning had to and did like set up the rapport, and they're like different, like, oh, they've been through a lot, they're like genuinely friends now,
yeah,
right? Mm-hmm. And it appears and peers to each other, like, yeah, they're both masters or whatever, or
well, knight
not a master,
knight and master,
right? No, yeah, and then it's poignant, like, you don't realize it till like on a future viewing, but like that moment when they kind of they're parting ways,
yeah,
early in the movie, that's the next time they see each other, it's going to be as Darth Vader and him fighting.
Yeah, like,
that's the last time those two, and it hits different when you see it the second time, knowing that that's the last time they see each other.
Mm.
And that just works really well. But it is unfortunate, yeah, that, like, I guess through Obi-Wan's eyes, we kind of see the fall too. Like, and the way that Ewan McGregor does it is great. He's obviously like giving his all to that performance, and that's the most like quintessential Obi-Wan is that version of him, like the like, the version who's disappointed and sad and like trying to do his best, but like he is like a fallen knight, as it were, right? He's like the Ronin, right? The disgraced samurai kind of girl, not through any direct fault of his own, but like that's what he was chewing on in Tatooine his whole 19 years. Is like, gosh, what did I do wrong, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that the Kenobi novel, which is not canon, but like that goes into that a lot. He's ruminating a lot about that. That's like a pure Western novel. I don't know if you read that one, but it's actually very good.
Yes.
I like it. But that's what I guess Obi-Wan show is kind of addressing the same topics, of course, too. The guilt and survivor guilt and whatever.
We also can't remember, I don't know how I forgot, but like the executing of Order 66 is all
Total. Very, very,
like the music, especially on Utapau, and like that is a tremendously sad sequence to me. Like, very, very sad. Like, the different ways that they show the Jedi being turned on, and the way the music that they use in those scenes, and even the small ways that Yoda senses what's happening.
Yep. Uh-huh. And, well, because the music's front and center, they like back off all the other sounds happening. It's like it's a musical montage.
It's very powerful.
It's really,
it's very powerful. It's very melancholy, very sad. But I think that, again, like, I think that that's part of what made me like appreciate the whole saga, the whole prequel saga, which is that, like, it had to work to some degree. Otherwise, you wouldn't feel anything in that moment. So seeing Ki-Adi Mundi get gunned down, or seeing other Jedi get killed, or that whole thing. It's so sad. And it's also sad because you're realizing like, oh, like I'm watching the end of the Jedi. Like, whoa, that's crazy. Like, what a tragic moment in like galactic history.
And at that point, we think that Obi-Wan and Yoda are the only ones left.
Right. Well,
until Force Unleashed comes out, and then a lot of other short novels.
I honestly have very little problem with the concept that there'd be a somewhat significant number of survivors.
Mm-hmm.
Just because,
I mean,
if you want to have Jedi in this era and you want to tell stories in this era, you have to have Order 66 survivors. Because if your only choices are Obi-Wan, who's on Tatooine, Yoda, who's on Dagobah, and then baby Luke, that's not, like, you have no other choices to play with
right.
in that era.
And well, it's also
only Luke by the end of Return.
I think it's also very realistic, like, right? It's like, it's like the flip side of it, right? Yeah, like, when World War II ended, not every single Nazi died.
Right.
Right? Like, some of them survived, and they ran off to different parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, like, and no matter how much of a master plan Palpatine has, what are the chances you perfectly kill every single last Jedi?
Yeah.
Like, that's not going to happen. And I think that that works for me. But yes, in the movie, we're not given any indication that anybody else survived, right? Although I guess it is kind of implied because Obi-Wan's like, we better go back and send the stress signal so that nobody else comes home. So it's kind of implied that they were concerned that there might be surviving Jedi out there that would come back and get trapped.
But did he know that, like, this was galaxy-wide, or that it was just, like, the attack on the temple, and, like, he was luring, like, this is the only place that they'd be attacked? Did he know how extensive that it, one instantaneous
yeah, that's a good across question.
The galaxy? He was sending it out to nobody, basically, turns out, except for Cal Kestis, of course.
Right. Well, and Kanan.
Yeah, and Kanan, yeah.
But, no, I think there was kind of, like, the realization when he contacted Bail Organa and he said that he was found Yoda, and then when Yoda addressed that it was nobody, that's when he realized it was, like, probably widespread, more widespread yeah. than just his troops.
Or just Coruscant.
Yeah.
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 So, and then, like, also, I kind of feel like the Clone Wars did help me as far as Order 66 goes, because, like, growing up, I always thought that, like, the Command Order 66 was more of a contingency in case a Jedi went rogue.
Huh.
Like, we didn't even get the inhibitor chip thing.
No, yeah, that was 20 years
until later.
That was a retcon, basically.
Yes.
Yeah, that was kind of a retcon.
They were following orders. It was the Crosshair School of good soldiers follow orders, even if you personally maybe don't. Like, if you have personal rapport with the Jedi General. Like, orders are orders from their boss, right? Because they're supposed to be, he's the Supreme Chancellor, and they work for him. The Jedi Generals work for him. So I
think the inhibitor chip explanation works better.
Yeah, it does, because, like, you kind of have to look back at,
how often they just turn on a dime and they kill all these people.
Because they're trained from birth to follow orders. Like, they're genetically modified and, like, enhanced, and they're perfect, like, the perfect soldier.
Right.
Bred from of that, you know.
But, like, even in the Clone Wars, it kind of addressed the fact that the clones were kind of losing that following orders mentality because of the Jedi.
Right.
So,
And in Revenge of the Sith, the clones were not really well fleshed out.
Right.
Cody is mentioned by name.
Right.
And there seems to be some kind of, like, rapport or history there. But I don't think Rex is really in it.
Nope.
No. Like, or anything.
Right.
Like, he's the blue ones you see, right? Like, when they're storming the temple, Rex is there, I guess. Or no, not officially. Because in the Clone Wars show, he's with
Ahsoka.
But anyway, yeah, like, he's, like, Cody's the only named clone, right? In the
Commander Cody. Which they were supposed to put in the Obi-Wan show, you know, that
version.
Really?
That would have been so great. Yeah.
That was supposed to be the guy he ran into on that planet?
Yeah.
Oh.
Oh.
Could have been.
No, that was a different clone. Well, they confirmed it, and his armor was 501st Legion. Oh, okay.
No. I was saying that was supposed to be... Cody was supposed to find Obi-Wan on Tatooine.
Oh, yeah.
And then he was supposed to help him and then stay on Tatooine, I think, when Obi-Wan...
Oh, to, like, be the tap-in babysitter for a bit?
Yes.
Like, the only one that Obi-Wan...
Or something like that.
Yeah, that's supposed to be the only thing that would get him off planet is X, and only if he had coverage. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't just leave. Like, obviously we saw in the show, like, when he's gone, trouble ensues. It's like that like fan edit where they took the whole 6 hours into a 2-hour movie. They cut out that whole bit. Like, they end Reva with her getting stabbed, and then, like, she basically implies she dies the second time when she gets stabbed
by
Vader. They basically leave her for dead. In that scene, and that's where they leave her story in that edit. And that works way better for me. But that means they cut out, like, Owen and Beru's, like, heroic, like, farm stand, which is kind of cool, but also, like, doesn't make... They would move away. Like, if that happened, like, if Obi-Wan brought them a baby and said, like, take care of this kid, like, and then they had that close of a call, they would have to, like... That's like going into witness protection and getting your cover blown. Like, they gotta go away now, again.
Right.
But, oh well. Anyway,
I think that as we're sitting here talking about it, I do really think that there are just so many good moments in this movie now that I think really deeply about it.
Yeah,
it really is. It really is the bridge.
Now, do you think that? So I know it's like it's a joke, obviously, because it's like a big meme all the time. But, like, slaughtering the younglings.
Oh no!
Is that like a unforgivable sin? Like, so that happened, and then we're like, oh, but he, like, comes around by the end of Return of the Jedi, but, like, Like the joke is like when he shows up as a Force ghost, and then all those little young kids are also Force ghosts. Not, like, what are you doing here? Like,
yeah,
you killed us all. Like, so, like, or is that the point that, like, no matter how horrible things you've done, you can still do a good thing, and, like, love can overcome that, right? And
yeah,
you can still make a good choice at any moment, even no matter what you've done. That's, I think, the moral point of Star Wars is, like, your destiny. If your destiny is to do good or embrace the light and reject the dark, it's never too late to do that. And Vader is, like, the case in point of that. Vader Anakin.
Yeah.
You know?
I think that for me, that... So the reason that work, that he's redeemable to me, is because of the circumstances surrounding, like, I, at least this is my interpretation, correct me if I'm wrong or view it differently, but I think that it was very similar to when Kylo Ren kills Han Solo, which is that I don't think that Anakin truly believe that the younglings were a threat,
right,
or that they were evil or that they were bad. I think that he believed that if he wanted to save Padme, he had to do these evil things
to get the power,
to be be fully in the dark side, right? Like,
jeez,
like the same way that Kylo Ren, I think he believed, or Snoke was telling him, like, if you really want to get end this temptation to go back to the light, you know, you got to do these terrible things, like kill your own dad, right?
Like a blood sacrifice kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think that in that regard, and it, which is, I think, what makes the movie effective, is that that is, I think, pretty obvious, right? Like, Anakin's not just, well, I hate all the Jedi now, let's kill them. Like, it's more like, because, like, he has that moment, you know, where he was told,
just like, you know, God told Joshua in the Old Testament, like, go and slaughter everyone you find in the temple. He's like, okay, boss, right? Even if that includes younglings, like, he's like, okay, whatever.
But even in the scene where he's with Palpatine, he says, what have I done? Like, he's still not, like, he's still, and I will say this, like, I do think that there's some weakness in, like, that turning of Anakin wasn't done as well as it could have been, because you kind of have to fill in the blanks a little bit, because it doesn't make a lot of sense sometimes. Yeah. Like, it's kind of like, wait, what?
If you grab the, like, he's too dangerous to be left alive thing, like the hypocrisy of Mace Windu, right? Like, that's what did it for me. It's just like, you're no different than what you told me. Like, he's like, Palpatine told me straight up he's a Sith Lord. I told you that, and you didn't believe me. And then now you believe him, and now you're doing something about it. Like, he's like an observer to that, but it is like on a dime, more or less. Although you could say
the everything that Anakin does in the most of the last third of the movie, I think he does it with very mixed feelings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's torn, because he's really, the primary reason he does anything is that he thinks it's the only way to save Padme.
And the Sith eyes are like the giveaway, right? He has that with the kids, and he has that, like, when he's slaughtering the whole, like, Separatist Council guys on Mustafar. Like, the Sith eyes are when he's in that, like, rage state or whatever, and he might be somewhat, like, separated from his other self in a sense. Like, it's like an out-of-body experience, like a blackout, like your blackout rage kind of thing, maybe. Is what's kind of going on there, I think.
And I do think that it's realistic to think, because I do think that that plays out all the way through to the end of the movie. Like, right, like even at the end when he gives that cringy, no, you know, he's, I think part of it is that if you just watch A New Hope, right, like, there's no backstory. So Vader's just this, he's just evil incarnate. There's no understanding of who that person is. So even when he gets redeemed at the end and Return of the Jedi, it's still kind of like, well, okay. But I'm not really sure. But then you get the whole story, right? Mm-hmm. The whole background, right? Like, the whole idea of, like, when Vader, like, right? Like, the scene that always gets me the most is the scene in Return of the Jedi where Luke turns himself in.
Yeah.
That hits so different after Revenge of the Sith, right? Like, because then you're like, oh, I see Anakin, and that's Anakin.
Yeah, it's true.
It's Anakin. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I do think that because Anakin was never like, he was never a true believer. Like, he was never like a card carrying, like, you know, mm-hmm. I always wanted to be a Sith and now I'm finally a Sith. It was more like, I didn't really have a choice. I had a vision of my mom dying and sure enough, she died. So I'm either going to do what this evil, manipulative,
yeah.
you know, dark person tells me, or I'm going to lose everything I love. Like, I'm going to lose it all. And I think that that makes the redemption more believable because Anakin is carrying that with him, right? Like, he's carrying that in that Vader costume as this guy who's like, fucking lost everything, man. I lost everyone. I got duped. I got manipulated. I got ripped off.
Yeah.
And the only one I can blame is myself. Like,
so in a rewrite, if I could rewrite it all, I would have it. I'd have a couple things different. I'd have, I would have stuck with the, like, so you can have Anakin be the father of Luke and Leia, but also that, like, Padme, her boyfriend or husband was, like, Anakin's best friend, who's another Jedi you could make that is also, like, the Padawan of Obi-Wan. And, like, so, like, you can have, like, he was a pupil of mine until he turned to evil. He betrayed and murdered your father.
Yeah.
Would be, like, yeah, he was, like, he was hooking up with Padme, whether married or not. But then, like, but Anakin was a sexual rival.
Right.
And then, like, ultimately killed his friend to take over the girl and then, like, forcibly impregnate her, you could say. And so he is, like those kids could be, the product of that. As, like,
kind of like Snape?
Yeah, so I was thinking, like, a Harry Potter thing, where, like, so he comes in, so, like, they could have really played up the, like, he's too old to enter the academy. They could have had, like, the what's his face? Potter, that kid.
Malfoy.
Yeah, you could have, like, a Malfoy foil. So, like, so basically, like, you could have had Palpatine have, like, so when Anakin comes in the academy at 9 or 10, he's got all the, like, all the Gryffindor kids or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And then, like, but they don't accept him. It's kind of like Harry Potter. Like,
right.
He's a muggle or whatever. And then he could be, like, you could do, like, the school shooter angle, quote unquote, right? Where, like, Anakin is, like, bullied and, like, harassed. And Palpatine picks up on that and, like, he's like, yeah, you want to kill him, don't you? Yeah, yeah. And finally, these guys all grow up, and now they're all the generals, right?
Uh-huh.
They need to be taken out of the way if Palpatine wants to take over. So he uses Anakin to, like, take out, like, all that layer of the you know, battlefield leadership, where he, like, empowers Anakin to, like, take revenge, the revenge of the Sith, take revenge on all these people who wronged him all the way up, all the way through school, quote unquote.
Okay.
And he even gets he takes the girl at the end that he always wanted, that he always felt like he deserved or whatever, and kills, like,
but then that character would have been less redeemable.
All right.
That's true. Yeah.
But I like I'm tracking
right. Like, that's, you get where I'm going.
Really good alternative storytelling there.
Yeah,
for sure.
I was kind of more of a rip off of Harry Potter, but
right.
Which came before this, so yeah. That's the headcanon. I mean, we got what we got, but, like, again, it'd be nice to see, like, that story of episode 2 and 3, if they stretched that into 3 movies and didn't do one at all, as it is, episode 1 could have been 18, 17, 18, 19 year old Anakin, who could have been, like, they could have played up the boy wonder thing, right? So it's like, for him, it's like the, and they could have even had, like, Qui-Gon or even have Obi-Wan be, like, the stage mother kind of trope, where, like, he, you know, like his, like, persnicketiness or whatever really, like, drove him to madness.
Oh,
you know what I mean? So, like, he would, yeah,
he's like Mother Gothel from Tangled.
Like, or like the mom from Arrested Development.
Right.
Like, some kind of dynamic a little bit like that, where, like, he was young and immature, and he was not ill. I mean, they did go into this, like, he wasn't the best fit for Anakin, but he, like, defaulted into it. But anyway.
I think that at the end of the day, what comes through in the movie does work to flesh out what happens in the original trilogy. Even though, like, I think there are, you know, we've talked, you and I have talked about this probably more on our own podcast, but, like, it's the prequel peril, right? Like,
yeah.
Like, anytime you take a story that's already been told, right? Like, when George Lucas told that's the story of the original trilogy, did he have treatments? Yes. We know that he had treatments for the what would eventually be the prequels. But whenever you tell the story backwards, right, you're just going to have all these gaps, right? Like, and you have to be able to excuse that if you want to stay tracking with the story that you're being told. And I think that Revenge of the Sith, like is the point, especially in the last third probably, where it fully kind of overcomes that those gaps.
Yeah.
And it brings you it when it finally has to connect you to A New Hope, I think it pulls it off.
The only thing that is still a gap to me is like the whole point is he wanted to save Padme, but then he like chokes her out and you know what I mean? Like, you turned against me. Uh-huh. But I guess they're saying, like, he's so lost to the dark side that, like, he even lost what his rational quest was. Yeah, crash point, as the kids would say.
He's also
consumed by the dark side fully.
He's also, which I think they didn't develop enough, but, you know, you get those hints in Attack of the Clones of his frustration with democracy.
Yeah.
You know, which is even more prescient now.
Yeah.
But, like... Yeah. He kind of has that, like, I feel like they
could develop that. I'm going to take over, I'm going to kill the Emperor, and we're going to rule together. Like, even is...
That sequence with Padme, right, where he's like, he says those things, and then he goes, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
But not really.
Every girl has that date nowadays.
But I feel like you could have developed that a little bit more, like, given Anakin a little bit more of a political side.
Yeah.
Right? And where he could see... Like, his frustration, like, that... Because the war is what keeps him separated from Padme quite a bit.
Yeah,
so you could really have developed that a little bit more to where he's, like, kind of, like, torn. Like, he's, like, a classic, like, you know... He's, like, the soldier who's signed up for the cause.
Yeah.
But he's struggling to believe in it.
Yeah.
Because he feels like, this is stupid. Can't you just fucking agree and end this war, you know? Like, I want to spend more nights with my wife.
You know, the angle where, like, he's sick of, like, the bloodshed and, like, the absolute, like, just, like, World War One, it's getting nowhere. And, like, somebody needs to make a decisive decision to, like, end this war and end the bloodshed and end the violence.
Right.
He's going to do what it takes to end this thing.
Right.
And which Palpatine, I think is... Right? And the Palpatine's like, oh, yeah, sure, that works for me, right? You know? And, like, he unwittingly ushers in, or not even unwittingly, he's like... Yeah, I agree. Like, we need a more authoritarian hand. Like, democracy isn't working. It's what got us in this mess. Right. And to have peace and security. Like, we're going to trade peace and security for liberty. Liberty out, right. Peace and security in, which is, they made a point to say that in the movie, right? Liberty has and stuff. And so, and that is the trade-off, right? In the meta, of course, that plays out in real life, too.
And Anakin says it explicitly on Mustafar. Yeah. He says, But I just feel like it was just kind of like that. I mean, he just said it. And they were like, oh, well, that's what he believes.
Yeah.
But we didn't really... get that fleshed out as much as maybe it could have. And I think that I think that might go more to your point of, like, I think they could have benefited from making the story longer about Anakin's post being a kid.
Like, his post, like, you could have had, again, you could have had episode one, a different episode one gets you up to the point of, like, just, he's just about, all the seeds are planted and you're just like waiting for the fruit to bloom, and then somewhere in the middle of two he flips, and that's like, so the peak of the whole story is halfway through two, right? And that's where, you know, Palpatine becomes gross Emperor Palpatine, and now Anakin's Darth Vader, but he spends a long time being like Vader but not in the suit. Mm-hmm. Right? And then, like, there's a longer stretch where, like, he's falling, and his final fall is, like, physically into the suit, right, into the lava or into the volcano, as George Lucas says, right? And that could have been three whole movies instead of really crammed into two with a little bit of seed planting in two in the second segment, with, like, his mom, like, the mom is the stand-in for Padme later, of losing his mom versus whatever, but they crush it all into the one movie. So we have just a few minutes left before this runs out, by the way.
Okay.
So, final thoughts.
So, overall... I think if I had to do this on a scale of 1 to 10, and I feel like, and this one's kind of swayed back and forth for me for a long time. Like, and this one's kind of changed a little bit, but stayed in the middle for me for the most part. I'd give it a good 7.4 out of 10.
Okay.
Like overall, it's still the best. Well, actually, my personal favorite is episode one, but that's mainly because of the nostalgia and all that kind of stuff. It was a little bit stronger for that film than this one. But I'd say the only thing that did lower it was the acting. Like, some of the acting scenes didn't hit for me. But overall, it is a movie that I will definitely be seeing over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
I will definitely be doing first reactions with the next generation, like my nieces and nephews and any other youngsters that decide to be a part of my life. This will definitely be a hallmark, like a moment movie for them.
Yeah.
Like, I've met Ewan McGregor and Hayden Christensen in real life, so I got to have that be a part of Star Wars, my Star Wars life. I remember that being kind of like a closing chapter for me in a way, because I remember thinking that was going to be the last we'd ever have for Star Wars until now, obviously. But still, despite all the stuff that I didn't agree with the movie, the highlights are still there. This is definitely a big moment movie.
If I put Empire and Star Wars in the S tier, top tier bucket, and this and Return of the Jedi are in the next tier, the A tier, I guess, for me.
Oh, okay.
And then...
for the trilogy, for the Skywalker saga?
Yeah, for the six. The prequels and originals.
Yeah.
And then, like, V tier is the other two or three, whatever's left over. And then sequels are in B's and C's and D's from there. But this is, like, I think this is the best of the three prequels overall, but... the like nostalgia edge goes, like the honorable mention goes to two for
exactly
me. Close. Yeah, but right. I objectively I cannot say it's a better movie, obviously. Like I can good conscience say that, but it, in some ways, like as a third movie of a trilogy, it's probably better structured than Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, I would agree,
where they take almost too much time to rescue Han and then have a lot of like tying up of knots or tying loose ends up in the middle, and then you have the big, you know, multiple battles going on, which is fine, of course, but like it's a different structure too, so it's not really the same. But I don't know, is it a better third movie of a trilogy? Is it the best third movie of any trilogy that you can think of? It's better than, like, I don't know.
It's the Back best to the Future third three, of the, all right? Three Star Wars trilogies, I would say.
The best third movie of the three? Yeah, that's probably fair.
I would say so.
Return of the Jedi is close.
I think Return of the Jedi was a little stronger for me.
I think when you get from the point of like the briefing with the Death Star, like on the Mon Calamari cruiser, point on Return of the Jedi is like S tier to me.
Oh, okay.
Like the beginning, getting to that point is like it's a little bit slower, and then like Yoda takes forever to die, and then they have to like have Obi-Wan do his complete retcon about the father, and like, what happened was this and that, and you're like, okay, dude, like,
oh, okay,
George, you didn't know what you're talking about, it's fine, just, you're doing mental gymnastics here to figure this out, and like, Obi-Wan just comes across as like a manipulative, like, you know, he's diminished in this compared to how he was in 4, for example, but
anyway. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I would say that When the movie first came out, I probably would have given it like a 7. But if I go all the way up from then to when we all went to see it in the theater when it came out, and I remember just after that, and then seeing it be number 2 at the box office after 20 years, and after all those years of hate, like from a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if I had to score it now, collectively, like taking everything into consideration, I would go as high as like an 8, 8.5, because I think that it aged very, very well.
That's true.
And I think that I will say this, that for all of the flaws of the prequels, the reality is that it is one man's vision, more or less cohesively told.
Yeah. Well, with, like it or not.
Right. Yeah, like had no execution of it may have been a little flawed.
Right. Yep.
But
he went full George Lucas, whether you like it or not.
That was and it was very cohesive.
Yeah.
And like I said, for me, Revenge of the Sith redeemed episodes 1 and 2.
And the can't seen Kevin said of Rise of Skywalker.
Right. and Return of the Jedi didn't need to redeem anything because the first two movies were better.
Right. But, yeah.
But I do think that, and I will always have a soft spot for Revenge of the Sith, because honestly, a big part of that is my kids have such a strong, when we went to see that, you know, and Mariah was with us and she was a wreck. That whole night, like she was literally like devastated, like it she was really like five, right? Hit her. No, she was much younger than that.
Oh,
wow. You didn't see it when it in theaters when it first came
out. Oh, right, okay.
But I think for me a big part of it is that the fall of Anakin is something that my whole family, you know, like kind of mourns as if somebody really died or somebody we really care about, you know, went down the wrong path. So there's so much more I could say. We could all say, I'm sure,
but end it there.
Yeah.
All right. So, so that will end this episode, and, what a way to come back and come back. We will, be, coming back for a Star Wars Visions episode, hopefully. And with that episode, we'll also talk about my little journey that I took to the faraway place of Japan.
Oh, yeah.
And then hopefully we'll have a Christmas / maybe a look back at 10 years of Force Awakens episode. And then we'll enter into the new year of 2026. So... until then, may the Force be with you.
Always.
Always.
Great shot, kid. That was one in a million.
What about the droid attack on the Wookiees?